when I was asked to talk about monitoring the disease, I thought it was sensible to break it down into two kind of broad categories. Monitoring the effect of the disease, as in, is our vision stable and is it getting worse? And someone's asked a very pertinent question. Should I be on treatment? What's happening? Am I getting worse? The next thing we need to monitor is our therapy. Are we taking the medications? Compliance with therapy, it's an emerging field. It's critical that patients comply with therapy. Is our therapy effective? And the side effects, how do we monitor for side effects? Everyone with birdshot in this audience is going to be wondering, is this disease getting worse? And if so, how quickly? I think one of the problems with birdshot is that for ophthalmologists, our clinical techniques that we have brought up and we spent years fine-tuning are not really good enough. Miles has talked about these birdshot lesions. If you look at a patient a year down the line, on treatment, off treatment, they look pretty well the same. A few more lesions there, maybe a few have gone, some pigment over. They're not really good enough to tell us if the disease is progressing. And that is a big problem with birdshot. We need to use other measures. Visual acuity, in terms of our acuity measures, is obviously a macular-driven function. It's critical. We rely on it to see, to read. But it's not good enough. It's obviously important, but it really only samples a tiny area of our macula, a few thousand ganglion cell fibers. And there's a parallel with glaucoma, which is an entirely different disease. But patients can have 20/20 vision, driving acuity vision, but be utterly disabled with glaucoma because they've lost the whole field of vision. So glaucoma, you cannot monitor glaucoma purely with acuity. And the same applies for birdshot, because everything else is changing in our retina. Our loss of our field of vision, colour perception. I'm interested in motion perception, which we'll talk about. The flickering symptoms that we get, the glare. These are all general other measures of macular and retinal function. Dark adaptation. So again, the difficulty is that acuity isn't much good for monitoring the disease, although it's obviously important. Luckily, we have imaging technologies, and many of you will be familiar with what we call OCT, ocular coherence tomography. This is a laser-type scan. It's basically doing an optical scan through the layers of the retina. This is at the fovea. This is where we get our fine, detailed vision. This is a major cause of loss of vision in birdshot, where we get intractable, persistent edema within the layers of the retina. Thankfully, we have incredible technology that we can at least measure this non-invasively now. We don't have to inject patients with nasty dyes. We can measure the volume of this. We can look at long-term change. One of the drawbacks is that you can still see a patient that has normal anatomy with very poor vision because they just lost photoreceptors. That's not the be-all and end-all. It's telling a structural change. One of the other problems with birdshot is that these birdshot lesions that were described and as though you're firing at shotgun target, they actually lie in the choroid underneath the pigmented layer of the retina. And OCT imaging doesn't image that very well at the moment. It is improving, and we are beginning to be able to look at these actual birdshot lesions, which is where we believe the disease is actually coming from. So new technologies, the latest OCTs will be beginning to image these. But we've got no idea how on earth we're going to measure these things. Monitoring the disease. We've talked a little bit about visual fields. I have a great interest in visual fields. I fully admit that I'm completely biased, but I think these are critical for monitoring the disease. And many of you will be familiar with the Humphrey automated perimeter. It's, of course, primarily developed for patients with glaucoma, but it is very useful in birdshot. This is a patient who's had three fields over the course of 6 to 9 months. This is a central blind spot. Again, the French study have shown us that many patients have these central blind spots. And we can monitor the depth of this blind spot. We can see, is it extending? Is it deepening? Is it progressing? And the beauty of this is that at least it's automated. I have to be the first to admit patients hate doing these tests. But it probably is the best we have at the moment in terms of functional assessment of the visual field. And I believe it is important and useful. I think we perhaps should be putting more attention into monitoring long-term change. We can begin to analysis of visual field change. Problem is, you need a lot of data sets. You need to have fields for 5, 10, 15 years. You need to have 2 fields a year, possibly more, before you can get any sense of change. And we can take lessons from glaucoma, because the glaucomatologists have been doing field measurements with the Humphrey field machine for 25 years now. And they're many years ahead of us in looking for change analysis. I'm going to just pull up a few concepts which I think might be happening in patients in terms of perhaps their field of vision. I don't want to get too technical, but you can break down a field of vision into effectively normal and absolute loss of your total field of vision, and you can get a sort of numbering score, which is we call the mean deviation. And it gives us a kind of ballpark figure about how we're doing. All of us in perfect health are slowly losing our visual field as we age. So there is a normal, gentle decline. It's about 1 decibel per decade. So when we get to 70, we've already lost about 7 decibels of mean deviation, just with aging. Normal neuronal loss. And this might be a typical patient who is a young patient, perhaps healthy till the age of 40. He starts to get visual symptoms. He develops birdshot. We don't know how long for, maybe a few years. He has flickering, glare, see several ophthalmologists, people don't know what's going on, one goes from one unit to the other. This is a typical story. Things aren't quite right in his field of vision. And actually, he's developing these scotomas. The things are changing quite quickly. Eventually, maybe some birdshot lesions actually appear in the retina. Sees an ophthalmologist saying, there's something strange in that retina. Let's do an HLA-29 test. The penny drops. By then, he's actually had a few years of quite accelerated visual field loss. And the critical thing is here that we make the diagnosis, and then we've got to begin treatment. And we really need to monitor, and we don't know how quickly that disease is then going to progress. Obviously, we want to normalize and flatten off any further decay. And the best we can do is to bring it back up to normal aging again. And it depends how effective we are in that treatment. So if we've lost quite a lot of field of vision in a few years, this patient may continue to worsen even though we've effectively switched off the disease, because he's a young patient and he had a period of several years of loss of field. And you can see that if this line continues, even with the best treatment we can possibly imagine, he's going to run into problems with driving, perhaps in later life, loss of reading if the disease isn't that well controlled. I'm going to contrast this with another patient. Similar to the question that was asked earlier, let's take an older patient. Maybe he's 70 years old, has a few years of mild symptoms, the symptoms are mild, makes the diagnosis, and then maybe his course, even without therapy, is fairly mild. Okay, if we give him aggressive treatment, we could normalise that curve, but he's going to have to reach the age of 100 before he's at risk of losing his driving licence. Because he's older, he's possibly got milder disease. Now, we don't really understand the nature of the progression from an individual subject basis, but that's what we need to do. So I think the rate of progression is critical in the first few years to give us prognostic information. We've had a little bit about electrodiagnostics. I'm not going to dwell too long because I'm conscious of time. It's short. There's an outstanding poster outside all about the importance of electrodiagnostics. But we can measure the electroactivity in the retina. And we can use this for monitoring.
Helpful, critical for diagnosis as well.
Here's just an example. It can improve with treatment. This is what's called the ROD ERG, which is a summary measure of the electrical activity in our ROD system, dark adaptation, dim night vision. This is an ERG that's almost extinguished, it's almost non-existent at the time of diagnosis in a patient. And it improves after treatment to a more nearly normal level. This is a normal ERG for comparison. And now we at least have some electrical activity in the ROD system. One of the problems is it's time-consuming. It's difficult to standardize between centers, although it can be done. And there is variability in the electrodiagnostic measures. Okay, so it does have some drawbacks. A little bit about motion perception, purely because I'm interested in it. One of the problems with functional questionnaires, so they often don't ask about motion perception losses, and I'd be interested if anyone is kind of aware of difficulties. These might be difficulties following a tennis ball or a golf ball, or just being unaware of things appearing from the periphery in terms of moving targets. We can test for this in glaucoma, and we're thinking of doing this in birdshot, and there is a laptop-based test, which I'm just going to show you very quickly. Patient views the central target, and we've got some peripheral stimuli, and we can even have a go. So if you view the central target, hopefully you'll see one of the bars move. And the idea is that the patient would press a response key when they see movement. And we'd like to monitor motion perception. Moving on to treatment, for the last 5-10 minutes or so, critical is monitoring compliance. Are our patients really taking the therapy? And I think we're very bad at clinicians. We don't have the time in clinic to really assess the compliance of therapy. Of course, compliance with therapy depends on many factors, how much medication the patient's on, knowledge and understanding of the disease, the support the patient is getting, information, many, many factors. Are our treatments safe? Every patient with birdshot, I think, on systemic treatment, really topical, is going to be thinking, is this treatment going to affect my health? Is it going to shorten my life? Is it going to give me ill health in later life? Those of childbearing age, is it going to affect my offspring? These are pertinent questions that every patient's going to be thinking. Some of you will be on oral steroids. Just spend a little minute or two talking about them. There's been a few very good reviews in the literature that despite 60 years of use of oral steroids, we're still quite poor in our understanding of the true incidence of side effects. And there's uncertainty about the side effects of steroids. And a recurring theme is that studies always look at treatment effects, but they very rarely dwell on the true prevalence of side effects. They're not very sexy looking at side effects. We want to see if our treatment works, but we'd rather not kind of look in too carefully at the side effects. We do have some data, and this is a kind of summary of our current of literature understanding. And this would apply to patients on what we would think low-dose oral prednisolone therapy. And I would classify that up to about 10 milligrams of prednisolone a day. So what do we know about long-term health risks associated with oral steroids? Well, probably, and this is actually to my surprise, but this has been validated with quite good evidence, probably is no real risk of hypertension or stroke. There is possibly an increased risk of diabetes, although it's not very large, which is reassuring. Gastric ulceration, we know. There is certainly an increased risk of osteoporosis, although it's poorly understood. Hip necrosis, we have no data. Mood disturbance is very poorly understood. And again, already at this meeting, I'm getting a feel for the side effects that patients are going to experience on steroids. Very poorly understood. The long-term effects of low-dose steroids in terms of one's mood, in terms of depression, lethargy, very under-researched. We do know a bit about preventing steroid-induced osteoporosis. There are very well-established protocols, but the problem is ensuring compliance with that. And who best to do that? I think patients should be empowered. They should know about these protocols. GPs should be aware. Ophthalmologists should be aware, but possibly we're the worst and the least aware. And then there's the assistance of the rheumatologist, possibly. There are protocols for preventing osteoporosis for those patients on steroids. They're well established. This is the one from the Royal College of Physicians. It's quite complicated, but it depends on age, other risk factors, your mineral bone density at the start of going on steroids, and then additional measures that are given. Some of you will be on alendronic acid, calcium, etc. Quite a complex pathway, and it probably needs expertise to manage. But it is established, and I'm not sure ophthalmologists are possibly the best at monitoring for that. We need to figure out a way of ensuring our patients do not get steroid-induced osteoporosis. Immunosuppressive monitoring, and this is just a slide for discussion. How should this be coordinated? We're talking about patients on CellCept, Dazeparvin. You can see there's some fantastic posters about the side effects of immunosuppressive agents. How do we coordinate safe monitoring of these agents? Is it in the hospital eye service, perhaps with a nurse practitioner on service? GP. Many GPs are very, very unfamiliar and very unhappy about prescribing or getting at all involved with immunosuppressants. I'm not going to prescribe these. I don't want to assist in the monitoring. It's your job. Hospital physicians, rheumatologists, physicians used to prescribing immunosuppressants for other disorders. One of the problems is that birdshot's a rare disease. GPs probably many GPs have never heard of it. it's without, as far as we know, systemic features. And that is a difficulty in a sense that if you have rheumatoid, most GPs are much more familiar seeing a patient perhaps on methotrexate or an immunosuppressive agent because they've got hundreds of patients with rheumatoid disease that they co-manage with rheumatologists. But they've never heard of birdshot, and there's no systemic association. Very few physicians want to assist, and that is a difficulty for us as ophthalmologists. But we do need close cooperation, I think, with physicians looking for side effects and assisting with monitoring. And the other thing is our treatment endpoints of the actual disease are poorly defined. So we don't even know if our treatment's being effective. And that contrasts with some of the other diseases where there's better endpoints. Just as a final slide, really, how safe are immunosuppressants? Well, they're actually probably safer than we really think. Now, not to say for a moment there are not side effects, very nasty side effects with these agents. But we do have data, finally, about their long-term safety. And there are a few papers out there looking at thousands of patients with ocular inflammatory disease, some of whom will have birdshot. There probably is no increased risk of death on long-term immunosuppression. And there's no increased risk of death from cancer. Having said that, we may hear a little bit about anti-TNF agents later, things like rituximab, infliximab, and there probably is increased mortality with these agents. So we must be cautious about these agents.
So TNF, please?
Tumor necrosis factor. These are what we might call biologicals. We probably will hear a little bit from Carlos about their usage. Okay. There may be no patients in this room on these therapies, but these are, you will be reading about these. There are people are looking at these biologicals. But we don't have the data, and there may be more concern about it. So newer agents are always exciting. The trouble is, as I've alluded to earlier, that trials like to look at efficacy while they often kind of forget about side effects or their secondary outcome measures, and this is a big problem. And the safety of agents is really only apparent many years after they've been released. You need post-release data. And what you need is you need thousands of what we call patient years. This is one patient taking your medication, your tablet, your injection, whatever, your infusion, whatever it is, for a year. And you need thousands of those before you can ascertain long-term safety. We have that data with the traditional immunosuppressive agents, which you'll see outside. But we're really going to be some years off acquiring them for these newer agents. These traditional agents, for sure, have side effects, and there's a whole detailed list of them, but at least we have probably 30 years experience with them, and at least we have pretty robust safety data. Thank you.